Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, 50 years of British rock. A bit later on the show, we'll hear an in-studio performance from a contemporary band, Arctic Monkeys. But we'll also travel back to the heady days of the Manchester music scene in the late 80s, when a band called the Stone Roses released their self-titled debut album. We'll hear from the filmmakers behind a documentary that tells about the breathtaking rise and equally breathtaking fall of the Stone Roses. But first, the two British acts that really started it all, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. A few months back, we staged a Beatles versus Stones debate at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts here in Manhattan. Our guests included actor Mike Myers, his brother, the rock journalist Paul Myers, the musician Bill Janovitz, and Ophira Eisenberg, host of WNYC's Ask Me Another. It was a pretty feisty hour, and you can download the podcast at soundcheck.org. But there's a recent book that dives deep into this classic but quixotic question. Are you a Beatles person or a Stones person? I wanna be your lover, baby. Seems like we've all had to pick sides in the greatest rivalry in rock music. But then again, the Beatles wrote this song, I Wanna Be Your Man, for the Rolling Stones, so how real was this rivalry? In his new book, music historian John McMillan says it wasn't, except for when it was. The book is called, naturally, Beatles versus Stones, and John McMillan joins me in the Soundcheck studio. John, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So if the rivalry wasn't real from the beginning, why are we still talking about this 50 years? I mean, this is one of the most popular things we've ever done on Soundcheck.
Well, it was a competitive friendship. You know, both groups liked each other and they got along and they could bond over a lot of their shared experiences. They admired what the other groups were doing. And yet at the same time, they never really stopped competing for aesthetic credibility or cultural influence or record sales and everything else.
And it is sort of part of the fun of being a music fan, isn't it, to be able to, like, argue music with your fellow fans?
Well, sure, because you know, they both had so much in common. They were about the same age. They came out of England. They both admired African-American artists. But then there were also some clear differences, and I think it's the differences that make the comparison irresistible.
Right, despite things like I Wanna Be Your Man, which shows them not as rivals at all, but as kind of, you know, as friends.
Right. At that point, the Rolling Stones had not yet shown that they could write their own songs. So Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were doing, you know, cover songs. And the Beatles came in and wrote I Wanna Be Your Man for the Stones. It was their second single and their first kind of big hit in England. And the Beatles were happy to do it because they got some prestige from seeing other bands record their songs. And they had more songs than they knew what to do with in some senses. Mm-hmm. But the Stones enjoyed doing a Lennon McCartney song to get going.
And was it John who said, well, we didn't give them anything good?
That's right. That's right. Mick thought that he was, you know, he flattered himself and thought the Beatles had given him one of his best songs. And John said, no, that was a throwaway. I wanna be your man.
So let's go back to the beginning. I mean, you said they were approximately the same age. They were from England. They shared a love of African-American music. But there were some marked dissimilarities, which, you know, ironically got sort of reversed in the public perception of these two bands.
Right. And one big difference is the class backgrounds of the two groups. And there were different class distinctions within each group. But on balance, you know, the Beatles were working class kids from Liverpool, and in England's class system. There just wasn't as much mobility as we see today. And so they were just facing a career of having low wage, low prestige vocations. And also the fact that they were from Liverpool mattered a lot to people from London, because Londoners looked down at Liverpool the way maybe someone from New York City might look at someone from the Deep South or Appalachia. They had a kind of snobbish, condescending attitude. And so the Stones, by contrast, who of course presented themselves as the more, you know, louche, you know, edgy or radical types, they were actually on balance much better off class-wise than the
middle
Beatles.
Class kids.
Mick Jagger got into the London School of Economics, which is a very prestigious school, and this was at a time when only about 2% of British kids even went on to universities. And Brian Jones did not go to a university, but he could have. He was an outstanding student, and his parents were upper middle class.
So how is it that the Beatles, who, you know, came from this rough and tumble neighborhood, went to an even rougher, tumbler neighborhood in Hamburg to hone their craft, how did they get to be the good kids? And the Stones, who actually were from pretty good families, were the ones seen as the rebels.
Right. Well, this was marketing. So, you know, when the Beatles first encountered their manager, Brian Epstein, they were still wearing leather and they were playing loud rock and roll and they were a little wild. When they were on stage, they would drink and eat and smoke and make wisecracks and everything else. And he was the one who gradually got them into suits and had them bow and conform and be polite. And with regard to the, with the Stones, it was a bit different. And initially, their first manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, wanted to style the Stones kind of like the Beatles. He had them in matching outfits and everything else. But that didn't last for very long. After a while, he allowed the Stones to, you know, present themselves in a more easygoing way. And even he encouraged them to be a little bit insolent in the way they dealt with interviewers and so on. And that contributed to their reputation.
And in a classic case of the grass always being greener, each band saw in the other something that they wanted. The Stones saw the success of the Beatles, and the Beatles saw this kind of cool factor going over to the Stones.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the Stones certainly were envious of the Beatles' commercial success. And although we talk about the groups being rivals, the Beatles always outsold the Stones by a pretty wide margin. But John Lennon especially, he looked at the Stones, and you know, John Lennon came from art school. He was a bohemian type. I think he would have preferred to have that image, the image that the Stones had. And John had the hardest time of all the Beatles, you know, conforming to the expectations that their manager set. And he had a hard time with the lovable mop-top image.
Right. We're speaking with John McMillan. His book is called Beatles versus Stones. It is out now, looking at the enduring and supposed rivalry, which was, you know, I mean, if we're still talking about it 50 years later, there's something to it. But again, they were friendly, they were supportive of each other, they were in this rarefied atmosphere at the upper echelon of pop. There wasn't a lot of company up there. Even as late as 1967, we have the Beatles helping out the Rolling Stones. You write about the session where they were trying to record the song We Love You, and it just wasn't happening. And what's the thing that turns that session around?
Well, the Stones were not getting along very well. They had a lot, you know, and they were frustrated with what was going on in the studio. And John Lennon and Paul McCartney showed up. And very quickly, by every account, they helped to restructure the song around their own high backing vocals. And they took a song that was not going anywhere and made it into a pretty terrific song. That's an interesting one because in England, it was a kind of a big hit. I think maybe it hit number 8 in England. But not in the United States.
Here it was a B-side, as I recall. We Love You is the song from the Rolling Stones with an assist from the Beatles. We is the Rolling Stones with We Love You, recorded in 1967. Paul's voice is hard to pick out, John, but John Lennon's high nasal voice, you can hear that in the background of the chorus there, singing We Love You. I mean, you write in the book, this is one of numerous examples of the Stones kind of following the Beatles' lead, right?
That's right. The Beatles had had this big hit with All You Need Is Love, which seemed to capture the spirit of the summer of love and the counterculture and whatnot.
There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time.
So here was the Stones doing a similar song, and John Lennon later on remarked that he thought he was a little peeved at the way the Stones seemed to be following and what the Beatles were doing.
So was the song perceived by the public as the Stones aping the Beatles, or was it perceived maybe as a kind of slam against the Beatles?
Not a slam against the Beatles, but the Stones all of a sudden began to present themselves as sort of hippies. And later on, they would come up with their album, Their Satanic Majesty's Request. And they show up on the cover with dressed in wizard outfits and, you know, looking
like very hobbitish.
Absolutely. And that wasn't really what their aesthetic was about. It seemed like they were glomming on to a fad. And the Stones were not the only group to do that. But certainly it seemed like they were following the Beatles' creative lead for a while there.
We're speaking with John McMillan about his book Beatles versus Stones, which examines the sort of creation myth of the Beatles versus Stones rivalry, whether it was real or marketing or imagination or some combination of all the above. Listeners, what do you think? Was it all fiction? I mean, did you really feel stronger about one band than the other? Give us a call, 866-939-1612. Were you a Beatles person or a Stones person? Or were you one of those people who said, I don't understand the difference. It's all music to me. 866-939-1612. Or leave us a comment at soundcheck.org. Speaking of the Stones kind of following the Beatles' footsteps, there are numerous examples that you bring up during the course of the book, one of them going all the way back to the early Beatles song Yesterday. What does this show to us?
Well, Yesterday is a song that is credited to the Beatles, but it's almost completely Paul McCartney's song. He wrote the entire thing, and none of the other Beatles perform in that song. It's just Paul and a quietly strummed guitar, and then they have a string arrangement mm-hmm. in the background.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday.
Of course, that was a huge hit for the Beatles. And then sometime shortly afterwards, the Stones came out with their song called As Tears Go By, which had Mick Jagger singing to a quietly strummed guitar with a string arrangement. The interesting thing is that the Stones wrote As Tears Go By first, but they didn't think they could really record it. It didn't suit what they were doing. And Keith Richards was very clear. He said if we took that song to the rest of the group, they'd have laughed us out of the room. So they didn't think of the, as Tears Go By was a Stones song, but then the Beatles seemed to be opening up a new frontier for pop music, changing the rules of the game a bit. Mm-hmm. And so the Stones released this song and had a lot of success with it.
So they went back to a song that they'd originally given to Marianne Faithfull to record and reclaimed it for themselves, because now it was okay to sing a ballad with a string section behind you.
That's exactly right.
It is the evening of the day. I sit and watch the children play. Smiling faces I can see, but not for me. I sit and watch as tears go by.
One example of the Beatles kind of paving the way and then the Stones coming along and doing it their way. We're speaking with John McMillan about his book, Beatles versus Stones. Once again, listeners, were you a Beatles fan or a Stones fan? Or were you one of those people who thought it was all just marketing and you liked or disliked both? Call us at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Or leave a comment at soundcheck.org. John, at some point, did this kind of friendly rivalry, which seemed to flow naturally out of two groups of young men in the same field at the same time, at some point, did this friendly rivalry turn genuinely nasty?
There are a few times in the very late 60s where the groups took to sniping at each other a bit in the press, and it was mainly John Lennon who was going through a difficult period, who, in a very famous tirade with Rolling Stones publisher Jan Wenner, sort of, you know, tore into the Stones for mm-hmm. for mimicking the Beatles and copying them. And that seemed to be his main complaint. But Mick Jagger said some tardy things as well about the fact that the Beatles had made their breakup such an acrimonious story for the press, and that he thought there was something a little tacky about what the Beatles were doing. And as I alluded to before, I do believe Mick Jagger, of all the Stones, resented the Beatles' commercial success and mm-hmm. would have liked to have reveled in some of that.
But you also write a fair amount about the kind of political views, not of the bands, who seem not to have very strong political views, but of the young people of the day and how they viewed these two bands was really quite interesting.
Yeah, this is what really got me hooked into the project many years ago. I was doing research on underground newspapers in the late 60s. And I don't know if people remember, but there were these countercultural and radical newspapers all across the country. And right around the summer of 1968, there was a huge debate among, you know, youth culture aficionados over which group had the right political perspective. And the Beatles were seen to endorse, you know, the hippies and flower power and gentle nonviolence and whatnot. And the Stones seemed to align themselves with the more militant, you know, street-fighting ethic of the radical new left. Mm-hmm. And as you were mentioning, I don't think either group was terribly committed to one strategy or the other. And so there was something a little bit stylized about this. But young people thought it was profoundly important.
Well, but they must have been very conflicted when John Lennon wrote Revolution. Because, I mean, just to listen to the lyrics
right.
here, you know, it's almost like kind of a smackdown of everything the youth movement was about.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be alright? Alright. Alright.
And then the Stones had their song Street Fighting Man right on the heels of that. And those two songs, situated next to each other, seemed to suggest a kind of ideological debate.
Everywhere I hear the sound of marching George Beethoven. Cause summer's here and the time is right for fighting.
John McMillan, the Beatles song has the sound of revolution with the distortion and the guitar and the vocals, but Lennon singing Count Me Out, the Stones with the sitar suggesting flower power and hippies are out there, you know, marching, charging feet, street fighting man.
Yeah, well, there's something discrepant, certainly, about the sound of revolution and the political message that that song contained, because, you know, this was the time of 1968, the Democratic Convention and the assassinations of Martin Luther King, and even around the world, in Paris and Mexico, students and the police were clashing. And John Lennon was he wanted a more gentler approach from young people, and that's what he was suggesting. Mick Jagger had apparently attended a anti-war rally in London around the time, shortly before he wrote Street Fighting Man, and that was perhaps the impetus for the lyrics. And he felt a little bit impotent because, you know, he couldn't really be out there, you know, at the barricades the way he claimed to want to be.
Well, you write in the book that, you know, he probably went there thinking it would be like a social event.
I don't think there's a lot of evidence that Mick Jagger had a very developed left-wing political consciousness.
So even here, even in this kind of final chapter of the Beatles-Stones rivalry, when it comes to politics, was there anything to it, or was that all manufactured as well?
It's hard to say. You know, John Lennon is such an interesting character to me because I think he was very bright but not particularly well-educated or well-informed. And, you know, he has the reputation for being the peacenik and everything else. But he was quite conflicted. You know, sometimes he actually seemed to endorse political violence, which is contrary to how people think of him. And again, with Mick Jagger, certainly the Stones are even more interested than a lot of people in making a lot of money. And I think that his radicalism was a bit faddish. I can't prove it, but he's never seemed committed to any real left-wing political cause.
John McMillan's book is called Beatles versus Stones. It's out now. And John, you somehow go through this entire book without letting us know which side of the divide you come down on. Although you do say early on, I'm an historian. I'm not going, you know, it's not for me to come down on one side or the other here. But take off your historian hat for the moment. Beatles or Stones?
Well, see, I get asked this question all the time. And I hate to be impolite, but I don't want to take a position in the book. And part of the reason is because, as you suggested, it's not my skill set to write about aesthetics. I'm not a musician or a rock critic. But also, I didn't want people to get into some kind of acrimonious dispute as they read the book.
So in other words, the rivalry endures and is still so close to people's hearts that even you writing this book and stating one position or another will get people's goat. Is that what you're saying?
I've already found that to be the case. In various online fora, people think that I've sided with one group or the other. What brings me satisfaction is that people seem not to know what I really believe. My friends know. I do have a strong opinion, and my friends know which band I like. But readers have not been able to determine conclusively.
And although I noticed the use of the word satisfaction in your sentence there.
Oh, so you think that implies something? No. I'll tell you, the book is about how the rivalry was constructed by fans and by people in the media and by the groups themselves. And that's what I want people to focus on as opposed to whether they think I'm, you know, favorable to one group or the other.
All right. Fair enough. Actually, it's not fair enough. But I guess that's what we'll end with. John McMillan is the author of the book Beatles versus Stones, and you can read it and decide for yourself where his secret sympathies lie. John McMillan, thanks for being with us on Soundcheck today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Love you like no other, baby, like no other can. Love you like no other, baby, like no other can. I want to be your man. I want to be your man.
You can download our podcast of our live Beatles versus Stones debate with guests including actor Mike Myers and radio host Ophira Eisenberg of Ask Me Another at soundcheck.org, or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our look at three generations of British rock continues with the filmmakers behind a recent documentary about the Stone Roses. We'll travel back to the Manchester rock scene of the late 80s, early 90s in just a moment. And then later, music in our studio from Arctic Monkeys. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you're of a certain generation of rock fans, those few seconds of the song She Bangs the Drums might trigger a wave of nostalgia. The band was the Stone Roses. In 1989, they exploded out of Manchester, England with this debut album, and then almost as quickly imploded in a morass of legal wrangling and personality clashes, leaving fans to wonder what might have been. Well, the band reunited in 2012, and that reunion is the subject of the documentary The Stone Roses, Made of Stone. The film's out on DVD and available to watch on demand via iTunes and Amazon. And the film's producer, Mark Herbert, joins us on the line from the UK. Mark, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi there. Hi. How are you?
So give us a sense of why the Stone Roses cut such a big swath through the music scene in the UK.
I was 18 when the album came out, and you know, a big music fan, and not just sort of chart music, but all kinds of music. I had some great, older friends and cousins who used to, you know, used to go around and listen to vinyl at their house. And somehow there was a movement of what the Roses defined was this kind of, it felt indie, like indie music, but it had this kind of new dance groove and a bit of funk. And they just, and it was weird. It kind of exploded at a time when I think that the music scene in the whole of the UK changed. And I think the Roses kind of spawned a lot of new music. So it was a time when, I mean, guys went from kind of fighting in nightclubs to dancing together in nightclubs within a year. You know, there was this crazy time where, you know, and everybody, you know, people started to get kind of baggy jeans and the haircut. And there was a kind of real belonging. And it was great that it didn't come out of London. It came out of the north of England, and I think that was why a lot of people jumped on it and felt, you know, a lot of people just hung on to this band and what they spoke for, and there was a beautiful poetry about the lyrics as well, I think a lot of people connected with.
Let's hear a little bit of the music from that debut album by the Stone Roses. In fact, they didn't wait long to make a great first impression. This is the lead-off track called I Wanna Be Adored. Stone Roses and their lead-off track from their self-titled debut album in 1989, I Wanna Be Adored. The Stone Roses are the subject of the documentary The Stone Roses Made of Stone, produced by Mark Herbert, who's on the line with us from the UK. And Mark, how difficult was it when the Stone Roses somewhat surprisingly announced that they were getting together for a reunion tour? How difficult was it to get this film made? To get their approval and cooperation.
Well, it was a crazy journey for myself and the director Shane Meadows. We knew Shane and me were big fans of the band, and the lead singer Ian Brown had played a cameo in. He was a big fan of a lot of the films we've done, the past the drama, and we had him in a cameo role in a TV series, and we kept in touch, and he. He rang Shane. We were just editing the last episode of a drama, and we're on our way to a film festival in France. And he rang Shane to tell Shane that they were getting back together, Shane's favourite band, which was amazing. And then the second thing was, would we be up for filming it? So there was no way we couldn't make the film.
So
you know?
He called you and said, "Will you make this film about us?"
Yes, and we hit it. We found we got on well with the band. They let us into the rehearsals. And at least for me and Shane, the worst thing that could happen is that we'd get to see them live, because we both missed them. For us, it was a big excuse just to see them live.
All right. So the resulting documentary, The Stone Roses, Made of Stone, directed by Shane Meadows, produced by Mark Herbert, who's on the line with us. And joining me in the Soundcheck studio is our old friend Jeff Gordonier, New York Times staff writer, author of 2008's X Saves the World, among other things. Jeff, good to have you back.
It's always good to be here. Thank you.
We can hear the enthusiasm still in Mark's voice,
yeah,
and all his family and friends so enthused about this band. Why was the reaction much more muted here in the States?
Well, first off, Mark said the key phrase there, which was, I was 18 when the album came out.
Uh-huh.
That's a pivotal phrase for so many of us with so many bands. You know, for me, I'm thinking of R.E.M. And for an American audience, we saw that enthusiasm sort of sweeping, you know, through the press, coming out of England. And for those of us who were paying attention, it sounded fantastic. There was this whole idea of Manchester, the city of bloom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody romantically wants to be part of a movement. And as you can hear in the music of the Stone Roses, there is this sweep, this epic sweep to it when they were at their best.
You mentioned Manchester.
Yeah.
The play on the city of Manchester. Stone Roses, they were, maybe Mark, I should direct this question to you. They were sort of the emblematic figures of Manchester, weren't they?
Oh, very much so, yes. They really... There was a movement in Manchester, warehouse parties, and they were part of that scene. And so both musically, the amazing relationship between Manny, the bass player, John Squire's amazing guitar, and Rennie, the drummer, there's this incredible funk, and, you know, we'd never heard anything like that before, and it really fused a lot of genres together. And I think what happened was that a lot of bands, if you listen to bands that came out a year after that, 2 years, three, four, five, it was all really, you could really identify the Stone Roses as a big influence on that.
I think that's a really interesting point in terms of their sound, because they had this shimmer of psychedelia, but they also had this snarl of punk rock. I mean, the lyrics are actually very dark and often very angry. And then they also incorporated dance music, which was a brilliant stroke. I mean, one of their great singles was Fool's Gold, which is just a great dance song. And so
and epic dance length, too. I mean,
like
on the
10
record,
minutes
it's
long.
Almost 10 minutes.
Yeah, 10, 11 minutes long. And they did that just as rave culture was blossoming. Had this darkness and the shimmer at the same time, so it was very romantic. And what happened? It's also romantic. Is their failure? They essentially squandered the moment. They probably could have conquered the States, but they botched it. They put out this masterpiece, and essentially vanished and into this, you know, quagmire of tedium, and just basically didn't make any new music for years. In the meantime, a little band called Nirvana came along, mm-hmm, with a whole different movement from Seattle. All these other bands, Mudhoney, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains. And actually, a few years after that, a little band called Oasis from Manchester.
Right.
Who had been inspired by the Stone Roses in the first place. So in a sense, they made themselves obsolete.
They had a moment, and they didn't grab
it. But in a way, you know, I got to say, in their defense, I have a special place in my heart for bands like the Sex Pistols, the Cowboy Junkies, the Laws, Neutral Milk Hotel, whom I associate with one true masterpiece. Now, the band might actually put out many more records, as the Cowboy Junkies did, and beautiful ones, but to me, it's all about the Trinity Session. With the Stone Roses, there's something kind of lovely and magic about the fact that it was all encapsulated in a few months,
yeah,
and it was powerful, and then they just ruined it.
Now, Mark,
it's very rock and roll. I mean, that's in some ways
it is
more
a classic
rock and roll.
Rock and roll
it's the
story,
same with the,
yeah,
Sex Pistols. It's just very rock and roll. This kind of implosion and self sabotage.
Mark, there's a big section of your film that deals with the reaction of fans to the Stone, yeah, Roses getting back together. You know, first gig of the reunion, which we're going to play. Now, set this up for us. It was announced the morning of the day, right, on BBC Radio.
They put months of effort into the rehearsals. We were there, and we filmed it. And then they wanted to play to an audience, and they could have sold the tickets for thousands of pounds because it was a small venue. It was 1,200 people, and they decided that what they would do was announce it at 4 p.m. The gig was at 7:30. The social network, Twitter and Facebook, went crazy, and they basically said the first 1,200 fans that turn up with genuine memorabilia, an old vinyl cover, a ticket stub, anything from the past, anybody who turned up, the first 1,200 people were getting to the show for free. And so we wanted to try and make a section of the film where it didn't really matter if you were into the Stone Roses or not. It was about belonging and feeling a belonging and excitement about a band. And so what we did was really quite a bold decision from Shane, was to take 20 minutes of the film and not have the band in it and just concentrate on the euphoria and frantic chaos outside a venue as thousands of people turned up.
I'll go running down the street with kids under their arms and stuff.
There's nothing like the frantic chaos of 40-year-old men.
And there was lots of 40-year-old men, you know, with the kid. And if you saw from the gig, and you mentioned Oasis before, that one of the people that was in the that turned up at that gig and who actually, quote, in the film said they're the best band to ever come out of Manchester was obviously Liam Gallagher from Oasis. Mm-hmm. It was a special moment. And to me, that was still the most defining gig I've ever seen. Even though we were working, I've never heard 1,200 people sound so loud, sound so euphoric.
And these are some of the fans, as we hear them in the documentary film The Stone Roses Made of Stone.
Why are they so important to people? Why are they so special?
You know and I know, but you can't write it down, can you? Well, these all know. Everyone knows. Tattoos. You know, there's a reason why I've still got my hair like this, like, 20 years later, you know what I mean? There's a reason why I've never worn a tie. There's a reason why I listen to that album at least once a week.
You know, you get an album or a band of songs or whatever, and you have it with you, don't you? Especially if they've split up for years. So you play it when you have a great time, you play it when people pass on, play it when you get married, play it when your kids are born. And honestly, I was in pieces then. When they started Made of Stone, I went to bits. I just never thought I'd hear it. And it, I know, I don't want to be philosophical or anything, but it makes you feel good that further down the line things come good.
So those are some of the fans of the band The Stone Roses. During the reunion tour, the unexpected, unanticipated surprise reunion tour of 2012 by the groundbreaking UK band. The documentary is called The Stone Roses Made of Stone. The producer of the documentary is Mark Herbert on the line with us. Jeff Gordonier, New York Times staff writer with me here in the studio. I guess I'll ask this question of both of you, but Mark, you first. You heard that last fan talking about, you know, you listen to the record when you get married and when people pass on, and, you know, when they started playing Made of Stone, I went to bits. Why was this such an unexpected event? What happened to make people think that this reunion would never happen?
Well, famously, and we cover it in the film, that publicly the band members said they would never reform, and you know they were so badly managed in the early days. They were there was questions about money going missing. The deals he signed were completely ridiculous for the band, and there came a period where they were creatively, the juices were flowing, but they couldn't release any music because they were embroiled in a legal wrangling between record labels. It ended bitterly. It was a slow, painful end, and so I never thought that they would get back together, because publicly the people that said they would never would.
Jeff, what about you? I mean, were you as taken aback by this reunion?
I think I'm taken aback by those comments we were hearing, because there's that, you know, that Wordsworth poem, I believe it's actually about the French Revolution, where he says it was bliss to be alive, and I think to be young was heaven. I'm misquoting it, but it you hear that in the voices of these people, which is that they're recalling that moment. Rock and roll, you know, to me in the end is about a moment or a few moments. I mean, I happen to remember seeing The Clash at the Hollywood Palladium in California when I was like 14. Some friends took me. And then I saw REM at the Hollywood Palladium a few years later when I think Reckoning was coming out. And, you know, to go back to that feeling.
Right.
I mean, nothing ever compared. I've seen many, many great performances since then, but nothing compared to the combustion and the romance of those moments. So that's what you're hearing in when these people talk about the Stone Roses. It's like, can I go back? Particularly, you know, as Mark is pointing out, because it ended bitterly. You don't want it to end bitterly. Can you put a you know, a little sweetness on it at the end? Can you cap it in a more positive way?
Yeah. Do you, Jeff, have a favorite Stone Roses song?
I do. This is the one. I love that. I mean, I really love every single song on their signature album, The Stone Roses, including I Am the Resurrection, which is amazing. But there's something about the propulsion of the anthemic quality of This Is the One that you know, you just can't shake once you've heard it.
From their 1989 debut album, also called The Stone Roses. That is the band, The Stone Roses. This Is the One, the name of the song. Jeff Gordonier here with me in the studio. Mark Herbert, who produced the new documentary about The Stone Roses, with us on the line from the UK. Mark, the band had a reputation in their brief period as a touring band as a somewhat, let's say, eccentric live act. Jeff, would you agree?
Well, I wanted to ask Mark about that myself because I never got a chance to see them live, and my only exposure essentially was the magic of YouTube.
YouTube, right.
Yeah, and you find all these weird clips on YouTube where they're like on a British TV show, they're performing, it sounds great, and suddenly they just stop. they just sort of like careen to a stop, and Ian gets surly and walks off, and John Squires looks like he wants to like throw his guitar or something, and you're like, what happened? And again, that's kind of transfixing. But Mark, what were they doing with some of those appearances?
I'm watching it like you. I'm like thinking, what happened? And you only there was a lovely contradiction between this kind of these performances, and you're seeing this stuff of this band that you know, they were young, they were adulate, you know. So who knows? I mean, I didn't know them then. But there was certainly an attitude. There was certainly, they certainly wouldn't take suffer fools gladly if things were going right. They would speak their mind. And I think there was a beautiful, I think that's why a lot of people identified with them as people. But what my experience of them on the film was, if you see the live stuff in the film, we, you know, this is why we put 35 cameras on that last section in Fool's Gold, in that we were amazed at how much effort and work and how good they sounded live. Mm. And I think that some of that stuff that you see them walking off, they're a weird band. If you take one element of the band out, they're not a band that you could suddenly replace the drummer. The drummer leaves, so you get another drummer in. Or the bass guitarist leaves, you get another. All four of them have this groove, and the way they practice, they look at each other, they're like in a diamond shape. So there's elements of Fool's Gold when he, you know, the lead singer's just not singing for 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
he's just stood there enjoying the three of them jam.
We'll be right back.
The Stone Roses, from the documentary The Stone Roses Made of Stone, a little bit of Fool's Gold, which goes on and on.
It goes on and on. But it still works. You know, my 7-year-old son, I put that on recently, and he just loved it. I think he was twerking, actually. He just went crazy in the kitchen listening. It really grooves. It's a good song.
And there you hear one quartet of Northern Englishmen paying tribute to another. A little quote from the Beatles' Day Tripper there in that live performance. Now, Mark, you were saying before, you know, that this is a quartet that's more than the sum of its parts. You can't take the drummer out, replace the drummer, and expect them to still be the Stone Roses. But there is a moment in the middle of the tour in Europe when the drummer, Rennie, walks off stage and goes home, and the whole thing nearly collapses again. We don't see that coming. There's nothing that kind of leads up to that. Did you see it coming? Is there stuff behind the scenes that didn't make it into the film?
No. I mean, nobody knew this when it happened, but at the time he was getting the worst distortion and feedback in his ear. He had ear problems for days after that. The distortion was unbearable. But of course, when it happened, I'm sat in the crowd, you know, behind the camera, just sort of going, thinking, what a great gig they're going to do, you know, because it sounded great, but we didn't know. So when it happened, it was terrifying. I mean, we really thought that we were in trouble. We thought we were going to have to ring our finances to say, you know, the film, it's kind of an hour long.
But, you know, terrifying, again, that's just a rock and roll thing. I mean, these guys there's a kind of instability in terms of, you don't know what's going to happen.
And
you
unpredictability.
Talk to them. And, you know, I actually interviewed the Stone Roses in New York City in the mid-90s for Entertainment Weekly when they were trying to make a comeback with Second Coming, or kind of trying to remind people that they existed. There was that charge in the air of, like, surliness. Like, it was a little scary. You didn't quite know what they'd say.
So, Jeff, do you have mixed feelings about the Stone Roses reunion?
No, I think it sounds great. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer, and we're supposedly, you know, sort of the more wary of nostalgia and the more wary of reunions and stuff. Although everything we're doing here talking about this is nostalgic and our enthusiasm is coming through clear. But so, you know, the Pixies made a reunion. I couldn't believe that happened, and I was thrilled about it, and they sounded great. So it's like the proof is in the pudding. When you hear the Stone Roses, you hear the Pixies, you're like,
they still got it. Yeah.
They're fantastic. Why complain about this?
Well, you talk about, you know, we wanting to experience, to capture it. Well, Mark and his crew did exactly that with the documentary called The Stone Roses Made of Stone. Mark Herbert, the producer of that documentary, Jeff Gordonier here in the studio, New York Times staff writer. Guys, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.
The documentary Made of Stone is now available on DVD and via Amazon and iTunes. En route to our studio in 2013, two members of Arctic Monkeys stopped to buy some maracas on the street. And you'll hear those maracas in action next in an unusual stripped-down performance by Arctic Monkeys coming up on Soundcheck.
Now it's 3 in the morning and I'm trying to change your mind. Left you multiple calls and to my message you reply. Why'd you only call me when you're high?
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today, we've already talked about two generations of British rock music, the Beatles and the Stones, the original British invasion, and then the Stone Roses. Next up, we'll listen back to our session with a band that's very much a part of the contemporary British music scene, the Arctic Monkeys. They joined us in the studio last year. The band's lead singer, Alex Turner, and drummer Matt Helders played some stripped-down songs and told us about the making of their recently released album, AM. That record has since gone on to win the Brit Award for Best British Album of 2013, basically the British version of the Grammys. Here is half of the Arctic Monkeys playing Mad Sounds live in the Soundcheck studio. Thank you.
mad sounds in your ears make you feel alright. They bring you back to life. Mad sounds in your ears, they make you get up and dance, they make you get up. Yeah, they make you get up. Love buckles under the strain of those wild nights. Run, but you cannot hide. Mad sounds in your ears, they make you get up and dance, they make you get up all night long. They reappear, they make you get up and dance. Yeah, they make you get up. Suppose you gotta do what you gotta do. We just weren't feeling how we wanted to. You sit and try sometimes, but you just can't figure out what went wrong. Then out of nowhere, somebody comes and hits you with an ooh la la la, ooh la la la, ooh la la la, ooh, ooh la la la, ooh la la la, ooh la la la, ooh. You got those mad sounds in your ears, they make you get up and dance. Mad sounds in your ears, they make you get up and dance.
That's Alex Turner and Matt Helders, lead singer and drummer, respectively, for the band Arctic Monkeys. They were in our studio last summer playing songs from their now highly decorated album, AM. Here's the song, Do I Wanna Know, stripped down for the Soundcheck Studio.
One, two, three, four. Have you got color in your cheeks? Did you ever get that fear that you can't shift the tide that sticks around like summits in your teeth? Are there some aces up your sleeve? Have you no idea that you're in deep? I dreamt about you nearly every night this week. How many secrets can you keep? Cause there's this tune I found that makes me think of you somehow, and I play it on repeat until I fall asleep, spilling drinks on my settee. Do I wanna know if this feeling flows both ways? Sad to see you go, was sorta hoping that you'd stay. Baby, we both know that the nights were mainly made for saying things that you can't say tomorrow day. Crawling back to you, ever thought of calling when you've had a few? Cause I always do. Or maybe I'm too busy being yours to fall for somebody new. Now I thought it through, crawling back to you. So have you got the good? Been wondering if your heart's still open, and if so, I wanna know what time it should. Simmer down and poker up. I'm sorry to interrupt, it's just I'm constantly on the cusp. I've tried yet to kiss you. Well, I don't know if you feel the same as I do.
but we could be together if you wanted to. Do I wanna know if this feeling flows both ways? Sad to see you go. Was sort of hoping that you stayed. Maybe we both know that the nights were mainly made for saying things that you can't say tomorrow day. Crawling back to you. Ever thought of calling when you've had a few? 'Cause I always do, so always do. Maybe I'm too busy being yours to fall for somebody new. Now I thought it through, crawling back to you. If this feeling flows both ways, we're sort of hoping that you'd stay. That the nights were mainly made for saying things that you can't say tomorrow day. Do I wanna know? Too busy being yours to fall. Ever thought of calling, darling? Do you want me crawling back to you?
Do I Wanna Know? By the Arctic Monkeys, recorded here in the Soundcheck studio back in 2013. To hear the full session and interview, just head over to soundcheck.org. And remember, follow us on Twitter or like us on Facebook to find out more about our latest in-studio sessions, live webcasts, and more. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.